Gotta get up, gotta get out, gotta get home before the morning comes. What if I'm late, gotta be...
Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as the News and Observer, The Week magazine, The Independent, New York Times, ClassicRock.about.com, Rolling Stone, BGORecords.com, and Entertainment Weekly.
We never thought we'd get older. We never thought we'd grow cold, but now, gotta get up.
This opening number, Gotta Get Up, appropriate for January 1 and the start of a new year, is brought to us by Harry Nilsson. We'll be hearing more about and from Harry Nilsson later on in today's program. But first, these trivia questions. The first trivia question for today is from FunTrivia.com. Question number one. John Bon Jovi's first singing appearance was as lead singer for a song from a Holiday album. Name that tune or that album. Hint, it was a 1980 Christmas song and album featuring characters from a well-known movie. Question number two comes to us from About.com. January 1, New Year's Day, is also officially known as what? Is it A, Groundhog's Day, B, Read a Book Day, C, Take a Nap Day, D, Avoid a Hangover Day, or E, Rock Around the Clock Day? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our first Transitions article is entitled Queen of Soul Tells Details of Illness Coming, and this was published by the Associated Press on the 16th of December, 2010. Detroit. Music legend Aretha Franklin tells Jet magazine that she soon will reveal what prompted her recent surgery at a Detroit hospital. Franklin told the magazine that friends know she is a lot more than the girl in the pink Cadillac on the freeway of love who also sings about respect, and that they have prayed for her without ceasing. The 68-year-old Queen of Soul underwent an undisclosed surgical procedure earlier this month. Franklin already had canceled concert dates and personal appearances through May. Franklin said in a statement Wednesday that she had been home from the hospital for 3 days and that she has a private nurse. She tells Jet she's putting Aretha together first and that doctors have ordered 8 weeks of rest. And this, just off the presses, Tina Marie, known as the Ivory Queen of Soul, dies. This is published by the Associated Press on the 27th of December, 2010, by Nikisa Mumbi Moody. And Miss Moody says, Marie, who made history as Motown's first white female act, but developed a lasting legacy with her silky soul pipes and with hits like Lover Girl, Square Biz, and Fire and Desire with mentor Rick James, has died. She was 54. Our regular transitions, today in rock history, brought to us by BGORecords.com. And today is the weekend of January 1 and January 2, 2011. What were the number one hits back in the past? Well, back in 1966, you may remember, it was Simon and Garfunkel with The Sounds of Silence. And 40 years ago this weekend, it was George Harrison with All Things Must Pass. If you were born on January 1, you share a B-Day with Country Joe McDonald of The Fish. Back in 1942, Country Joe and the Fish. Deaths on January 1 include Hank Williams. He died on that day back in 1953. If you were born on January 2nd, you share a birthday with Roger Miller, King of the Road, 1936. Deaths on January 2nd include Tex Ritter, the singing cowboy. He died on that day back in 1974. Miscellany in rock history this weekend. Well, back in 1962, the Beatles flunked their audition when Decca Records A&R man Dick Rowe isn't impressed with the Fab Four version of Please Mr. Postman and other songs. Rowe tells manager Brian Epstein guitar groups are on the way out. Back in 1965, this weekend, it was the U.S. government denying visas to Nashville Teens and the Zombies, who were already in New York, forcing the groups to cancel their tours. 45 years ago this weekend, it was the Beach Boys hitting the chart with Barbara Ann. And back in 1975 this weekend, it was the U.S. District Court ruling that John Lennon should have access to Department of Immigration files pertaining to his deportation case. He wants to know if the government's case against him is based on his negative comments towards Richard Nixon's presidency. Back in 1976, this weekend, Fleetwood Mac released Go Your Own Way, their first American top 10 hit. And back in 1989, CBS broadcast The Karen Carpenter Story, number one TV show of the week. And finally, 20 years ago this weekend, it was George Harrison becoming the first ex-Beatle to top the U.S. charts when All Things Must Pass hits number one. This next story comes to us from the New York Times, published on the 13th of August, 2010, by David Brown, entitled Rescuing 1970 from the Remainder Bin. James Taylor wraps up a tour with Carole King. A new Jimi Hendrix album makes its debut in the top five. Elton John has joined forces with one of his heroes, the extremely hirsute singer-pianist Leon Russell. Fans think music should be free for the taking. Is this 2010 or 1970? The answer, strangely enough, is both. Well, sort of. This is January 1, 2011. But looking back, from Michael Jackson's bank account to robust ticket sales for Roger Waters' Wall tour, pop has witnessed its share of unlikely comebacks this year. Perhaps the least expected, though, is that of the year 1970, just in time for its 40th anniversary. Pop culture nostalgia tends to run in 20-year cycles, making this revival even more surprising. Mr. Taylor and Miss King's Troubadour reunion shows, the second highest-grossing tour of the year after Bon Jovi's, according to Pollstar, which tracks tour grosses and ticket sales, recreate the period four decades ago when Mr. Taylor's career was kicking in with his Sweet Baby James album. And Miss King, a veteran brill-building songwriter not yet known for her own records, was simply the pianist in his band. On October 19th, Mr. Russell and Mr. John released their first-ever collaboration, The Union, which recalls the month in 1970 when Mr. John opened for Mr. Russell at halls like the legendary Fillmore East. Valleys of Neptune, an album of exhumed recordings by Hendrix, entered the charts earlier this year at number four, just like his Band of Gypsies did at number five in 1970. The article skips down. What's genuinely striking about these echoes of 1970 is that the year has rarely been treated as one of pop's landmarks. In the annals of rock history, it's never ranked in the league of 1946, the arrival of Elvis Presley, 1964, the Beatles overrun America, 1967, hippies reached the mainstream during the Summer of Love, 1969, Woodstock, 1977, punk via the Sex Pistols hits the States, and 1992, the year grunge came to the malls thanks to Nirvana and Pearl Jam. Even next to recent possible candidates for these slots like 2001, The White Stripes and The Strokes, revive garage rock, or 2002, the premiere of the regrettably influential American Idol, 1970 doesn't receive much respect. Looking back, it's easy to see why. That year alone, an astonishing number of defining acts from the 1960s collapsed. Paul McCartney announced he wouldn't be working with the Beatles in the foreseeable future, while Simon Garfunkel, who just released the instant standard Bridge Over Troubled Water, quietly broke up after a tour that amounted to only 6 concerts. That sequence was eerily repeated this year, when the reunited duo canceled its summer tour in the wake of Art Garfunkel's vocal cord paralysis. It was the year Peter, Paul, and Mary began an 8-year hiatus. Diana Ross left the Supremes, Lou Reed parted ways with the Velvet Underground, and Sam split with Dave, and Janis Joplin died. Even the Monkees, by them down to only 2 members, Mickey Dolenz and Davy Jones, made their last recordings and expired along with the decade that created them. The article skips down. From the New York pop concerts on Randall's Island to a Rolling Stones show in Helsinki, concert growers felt it was perfectly acceptable in 1970 to storm the gates and demand to be let in gratis, a precursor to the expectation among future music fans that they shouldn't have to pay for music on the web. Simultaneously, the country wasn't in such terrible shape either. A list of events that could have been subjects for 40th anniversary celebrations this year would have included the Kent State shootings, the Weather Underground's accidental demolition of a brownstone on West 11th Street in Greenwich Village, the near-disastrous Apollo 13 expedition, the beginning of the Charles Manson trial with opening statements that linked the murders to Mr. Manson's obsession with the Beatles' White Album, and the first use of the Republican Party's so-called Southern strategy. No wonder few wanted to commemorate 1970. Yet that confluence of events now marks 1970 as one of rock's, not to mention the country's, most fascinating and underappreciated years. Looking back, 1970 was truly the year in which any remaining slivers of idealism of the 60s gave way to the buzzkill comedown of the decade to come. The article skips down and ends with this. 40 years later, a generation gap continues to divide fans. Do you prefer the Arcade Fire or Keisha? And a new generation of balladeers, the likes of M. Ward and Bon Iver, offers an alternative to rock the same way Mr. Taylor and his peers did. Despite its plethora of bad news, the grooves of 1970, rock's forgotten year, play on. This next article from Stuart Levine, Daily Variety, published on the 29th of November, 2010, entitled, Bowl Serving Up Peas. The Black Eyed Peas have been tabbed to play at halftime at Super Bowl XLV. The Super Bowl TV's most watched program of the year will be staged February the 6th at Cowboys Stadium and aired on Fox. There had been speculation for months that the Peas would be participating, but official word came during the New Orleans-Dallas game on Thursday. Last year's halftime show, in which The Who performed, was watched by an estimated 153 million people. Others to perform during halftime on football's biggest day have included Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, the Rolling Stones, Paul McCartney and Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. Of course, no musician made more headlines at the Super Bowl than Janet Jackson. During the 2004 show, her breast was exposed while on stage during a duet with Justin Timberlake. Their repercussions were great, including an investigation by the FCC and fines against CBS, which telecast the game. This next article is from the Wall Street Journal, published on December 24, 2010, by Jim Fasilli, The Return of the Album. The year's best music took the long form, hours of exhilaration with Arcade Fire and Erykah Badu. Downloading of singles and frenetic bidding for the attention of pop consumers, it said the long-playing album is no longer a viable medium for contemporary music, but that's wrong. The best albums of 2010 used the format's ample length to create experiences by exploring recurring musical and lyrical themes. On the Arc Android Suites 2 and 3, Bad Boy, Janelle Monáe conveys the story of an android that time travels to challenge an oppressive secret society. The dazzling album moves seamlessly among funk, Latin, jazz, disco, and orchestral music with the incredibly appealing 25-year-old Miss Monáe out front, giving the artificial life form an encyclopedia of emotion. Note the crossover infusion of genres in all of these. Clocking in at about 2 hours, These Hopeful Machines by BT is more than electronic a dance album. The songs merge dance beats with power pop, spanning eras and whipping up a pleasing musical melange. Trained in classical music, BT bridges the songs with orchestral interludes, featuring a bellowing organ and synthesized strings to create a complex oral adventure. Music and Film reveals its thematic unity as it serves story and character. For Martin Scorsese's Shutter Island, a horror mystery set in the 50s, Robbie Robertson strings together a collection of eerie classical works punctuated by songs of the era that are disquieting in context. For its contribution to the project and its key intelligence, it's the year's best film soundtrack. Go by Jonesy is 40 minutes of pure exhilaration. The Sigur Rós vocalist unleashes his waif-like falsettos over daring, darting percussion, chiming synths, toy pianos, xylophones, and flutes. The music seems to come from a magical place where joy reigns and anything goes. Erykah Badu's New America Part 2, Return of the Ankh, finds its groove early and rides it across a musical landscape of R&B, hip-hop, jazz, soul, fusion, and pop. Miss Badu's witty, silky vocals and self-assurance pull us along for the ride. This is Lightspeed Champion, and it's also reviewed in this article, Extraordinary. Life is Sweet, Nice to Meet You has a carefree sense of exploration as it bends and twists 70s musical conventions. The British musician brightens his well-crafted rock and pop songs with harpsichord, recorder, and pun-rich lyrics he delivers with a queen-like sense of joy. Crash in the Party by the Russians also echoes 70 rock and pop. John Lennon, Big Star, The Raspberries, Harry Nilsson, Mop the Hoople, in particular Mark Bolan. But the album is more than an homage. It's a thoroughly realized work, bursting with a hook-filled songs and deft musicianship.
It's okay, take into account that it's not about a change.
This music playing in the background is from the debut album by local natives Gorilla Manor. It's an ambitious collection of bright, thoroughly of the moment rock and rich by soaring vocal harmonies, clacking percussion and slinky guitars that borrow on occasion from jazz and Afro pop. To call them the West Coast version of Grizzly Bear may sell them short, but that's not a bad peer group for newcomers. Finally, the album Heartland is a sprawling work built on Owen Pallett's boyish voice, magnificently mad orchestrations, and a fantasy world in which a violent man confronts his creator, named Owen. The narrator, who reminds us that his every move is guided by the singer, declares his love for Owen, kills him by driving a spike through his eye, and then asks, "Now that the author is silenced, how will they ever decipher me?" Try fitting all that on a single. Mr. Pallett wrote charts and played violin on Arcade's Fire, Brilliant, The Suburbs by Merge Records, that's local here in Durham, which draws from myriad rock styles in a thrilling wall of sound that embraces the voices of Wynn Butler and his wife, Regine Chasson. The band reflects in vivid poetic lyrics on the not-so-innocents, innocuous hopes, fears, dreams, and nightmares stirring in the residents of suburbia. So what do you know about today's featured artist, Nielsen? Well, according to this bio by WMDB.com, downloaded on the 25th of December 2010, he was born in 1941 in Brooklyn, New York, Harry Edward Nielsen III. Trademark is 3.5-octave vocal range, usually provided all his own harmonies on record. Trivia: the Park Street apartment that he owned in London was where Mama Cass Elliot died from a heart attack in July 74. And in September 78, the Who's drummer Keith Moon died at that same apartment of an overdose from a prescription drug he was taking for alcoholism. Nielsen's grandparents were Swedish circus performers whose act was known as the Aerial Ballet, which became the title for his second album. His cover of Fred Neil's Everybody's Talking was chosen to be played over the opening titles and during the first part of Midnight Cowboy from 1969. Other songs considered include Nielsen's own I Guess the Lord Must Be in New York City and Randy Newman's Cowboy, which he and Nielsen re-recorded later.
Remember, life is just a memory. Remember, close your eyes and you can see. Remember.
Nielsen gained early recording experience by singing on commercial jingles, including ads for Band deodorant, See and Ski, and Der Wiener Schnitzel. Several Nielsen songs were also later used in commercials, including Me and My Arrow for Plymouth, Good Old Desk, and more recently, a re-edited version of Everybody's Talkin'. Nielsen never made personal appearances, aside from one very brief European tour early on, because he knew he could never recreate his complex sounds outside the studio. He worked the night shift at a bank's computer center to have daytimes free to pursue recording and publishing deals, and worked on songs during his breaks.
I'll stand an hour knocking, knowing that my heart is mocking me. She doesn't live here anymore. I don't know why I bother. What else can I do?
Nielsen met the Beatles, which had been impressed with his first album, Pandemonium Shadow Show, early in 1968. He became close friends with John Lennon and Ringo Starr in particular, and he shared a house with them in Los Angeles during 1974. The three collaborated on several records in the mid-70s while their off-hours drinking binges around L.A. became legendary. The article skips down and ends with this. In 1971, Nielsen did a cover of the Badfinger song Without You, which appeared on his Nielsen Schmielsen album with haunting vocals that showed his incredible multiple octave range. The song went to number one in the charts, and he won a Grammy for the song. Harry Edward Nielsen III died in California in 1994 of a heart attack.
Just couldn't stay here without you. So when you get older and over your shoulder, you look back to see if it's real. Tell her she's beautiful.
This next article comes to us from Stephen King, entitled Harry Who? A must-see new doc tells the tale of Harry Nielsen, a little-known pop music legend who died a broke and broken man. This is published in Entertainment Weekly, the Special Reunions Double 10 album issue. According to Tommy Smothers of the Smothers Brothers, his name causes one of two reactions in rock fans, instant recognition or a blank stare. John Lennon called him my favorite group, perhaps because the artist in question was a genius when it came to double, triple, and quadruple tracking his own voice. One critic wondered in print why he didn't give more credit to his wonderful backup singers. He was the Howard Hughes of rock royalty, refusing to tour or even perform live. His ex-wife Diane called him the most insecure person I've ever known. A-list producer Richard Perry said he had a death wish. Songwriter Paul Williams called him a big bunny with really sharp teeth. They're all talking about Harry Nielsen, the subject of a sadly lyrical new film, Who is Harry Nielsen, and why is everybody talking about him? If you see one rock doc this year, make it Harry Nielsen. Given Nielsen's unpleasant decline and premature death, this could have been the stuff of a VH1 Behind the Music episode, but it's something better, lots better, close to genius, in fact. The article skips down and ends with this. The Nielsen, who had his breakthrough success in 1969, became a doughy used-to-be 20 years later, remembered mostly by people who listened to oldie stations. It's as sad as the heartbreaks Nielsen sang about, with the most conviction. Who is Harry Nielsen is some piece of work, an exploration of the dark side of success that's hard to watch and even harder to forget.
Why I did not go to work today. Thursday is such a crazy, lazy day. Thursday has its own peculiar way of saying hey. Sometimes Thursday almost makes you want to run away.
Harry Nielsen. So how'd you do on today's trivia questions? The first question was, John Bon Jovi's first singing appearance was as lead singer for a holiday album. What's the name of the song or the album? The song was R2-D2, We Wish You a Merry Christmas. And the album was Christmas in the Stars, Star Wars Christmas album. Second question, January 1, New Year's Day, is also officially known as what? Answer is, avoid a hangover day.
Thursday was a boat, I bet it sank.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time. Happy New Year.